Welcome to the Perry Johnson Laboratory Accreditation Podcast, where you can expect the latest news and discussions relevant to the laboratory accreditation industry. Today's episode is a previously recorded webinar. If you'd like to tune into our upcoming webinars, visit our website at www.pjlabs.com or give us a follow on your favorite podcast app. Thank you for tuning in.
Welcome everyone to the September 2020 webinar being provided to you today by Perry Johnson Laboratory Accreditation. My name is Michael Kramer. I am the Calibration / Inspection Program Manager at PJLA, and I'm happy to present to you today on our topic is Common Findings in Assessments to ISO IEC 17025/2017. One thing I just thought I'd bring out is the where we're at with the transition between the 2005-2017 standard. ILAC has actually extended this currently till June the 1st, 2021, primarily, of course, due to the COVID-19 issues. And that was sort of creating some barriers for organizations to put the resources in place to transition to the standard. I don't want to dwell on that too much. You see the announcement in front of you. PJLA, we're speaking on behalf of Perry Johnson Laboratory Accreditation. We're proceeding just as if it was still November 2020. There is a buffer in there. But we don't want folks waiting until the last minute, because as you see here on this announcement, after that June 1st date of 2021, 2005 standard will no longer be recognized, and we won't be able to accredit you. So you want to definitely make sure you get your assessments in if you are transitioning to the new standard. Don't want to wait until the last minute, because if there are any issues, any open non-conformances, they have to be closed by that June 1st date. So without further ado, we'll go on to today's topic, which is common findings. So PJLA, just I would say every assessment we're doing now is in regards to 17025 is for the 2017 standard. So we do compile data as far as the findings that we have written. And what I like to do today is just do a top 10 list. So we're gonna look at the 10 most common areas that's been tabulated where our assessors at PJLA are writing the most non-conformances. So we'll start in at number 10. And actually we had a tie, so you could call this a top 11 list, because I included the tie here, which is at number 10. So this is externally provided products and services. So this incorporates purchasing and also subcontracting. So that was 4546 in the 2005 standards. You don't see those words in 2017, but however they are there, they're just referred to as externally provided products and services. So looking at some of the requirements that you want to assure that you're complying with, this is an area, as you see, right out of the standard 662, you have to have a procedure and retain records. So what this is saying is you have to have a document or something that shows you how this is being completed within your organization, and then also show records that it's being done. Included in the 2017 standard is defining, reviewing, and improving laboratory requirements for externally provided products and services. Defining the criteria. So you have to have some sort of criteria for approving your critical vendors here or suppliers for evaluation, selection, and I highlighted monitoring there, because it's not a one-time thing as per the 2017 standard, and also reevaluation of the external providers. Again, a procedure and retain records, so how it's being done and showing that it's being done. 662C. I pinpointed ensuring the externally provided products and services conforms to the laboratory own requirement or when applicable to the relevant requirements of this document. This document, of course, being the 17025 standard, before they are used or directly provided to the customer. And taking any action arising from evaluation, monitoring of performance, and reevaluation of the external providers. Excuse me. So one thing I just want to bring out here is 2005, you had to list those approved. That was a requirement and list those approved. Probably heard me say this a lot during the course of doing the webinars. 2017 is less prescriptive. A lot more electronically driven. The language is more in tune with today's electronic age. So it's got rid of the word list. So, as you probably heard me say before in doing webinars, the list is something that, though it's not required, you can still utilize it and show that you are complying with this section 662. And utilizing within the procedure and perhaps also retaining those records for monitoring, reevaluation. What are you going to base that on? What criteria are you going to be utilized to select a vendor or a supplier? So criteria. So just want to expand on that a little bit. So I just got now, of course, not an all-encompassing list, just some things that could be used showing that you are have some sort of criteria for evaluating your suppliers, also for monitoring and reevaluating. One thing that always comes to mind is recognition. Top of the list there, I got 17025. So hence, if traceability and calibration, for example, is a requirement, as far as selecting those vendors, 17025 accreditation, of course. Monitoring is, as you know, accreditation is not a one-time thing. The organizations are subjected to reassessment, surveillance assessment. So, of course, monitoring would be assuring that they are maintaining the accreditation in the testing or calibration field that you folks desire. I got 17011. Always mentioned to folks when I was looking at the list, one vendor I would like to see on there was Perry Johnson. We are a ILAC signatory. So again, we should be evaluated and be approved and should be a part of this section here. And a criteria would be our recognition as an ILAC signatory under 17011. 17043 for proficiency testing. 9001, organization has a quality system, hopefully recognized by a register through the ANAB signatory. Other things that, of course, will be important to you is on-time delivery, suppliers audits, testimonials, number of years in business. I like to look at when you your critical vendors, they're sort of like partners with you. You sort of depending on them and you want them to be around when you you need them. Accuracy requirements and capabilities on the scope of our accreditation. Ranges and CMC. So again, if you have an organization, say 17025 is criteria, you want to make sure that the accuracy requirements that you are needing is going to be captured under the scope of accreditation. I, for example, can be accredited to do calipers, micrometers. You may have an accuracy requirement that I'm unable to meet because I don't have the environmental conditions and perhaps reference standards that another organization may have that would lower their CMC, which is another name for basically the best uncertainty that can be produced. So with 17025, you want to double check, make sure the scope of accreditation fulfills your requirement. Communication. So still here on the tie for number 10. So you have to communicate to your suppliers, clearly communicate the products and service providers, acceptance criteria, any competence requirements, activities at the laboratory or customers extends to perform at the external provider's premises, coming on site, doing on-site calibrations quite often. So again, the requirement here has been laxed. It used to require a purchasing document. It's no longer required. However, you could still utilize something like a purchase order and show that you are clearly communicating your needs to your critical vendors. All right, so we were tied with number 10, section 7.6, which is the evaluation of measurement uncertainties. Again, the requirements are somewhat lax here as opposed to the 2005 standard. We see a requirement here right off the bat, and I'll leave it up there for you to read, which is identifying the contributors. And if you read that and if you look at that and you folks are accredited with PJLA and are familiar with our policy on measurement uncertainty, it sounds exactly like what we require anyway, as far as an uncertainty budget, identifying, quantifying, and then combining those elements of uncertainty. That's an example of uncertainty budgets for those of you that perhaps are not real sure what I'm speaking about. We typically have contributors such as repeatability, uncertainty due to the standard use, resolution of the device under test, which are always included. Then from there, it pretty much depends on what the calibration is and what type of uncertainty is being magnified. Could be environmental, such as like temperature, humidity, uncertainty that affects the calibrations. So again, organization is required to evaluate the uncertainty. 2005, not so much. And again, this is something, if you still have a procedure in place, it can still be used to show how uncertainty is being evaluated, but it's not required. 2005 was very specific about an uncertainty procedure. Testing lab. So you folks that are involved in testing, this is not something that you can just ignore. There are requirements in the standard regarding testing labs and uncertainty. So if you're a testing lab, you shall evaluate measurement uncertainty where the test method precludes rigorous evaluation of measurement uncertainty and estimation. Maybe based on an understanding of the theological principles or practices, experiences of the performance of the methods. So I'm a sort of a head scratcher there. So what exactly are we referring to here? Where the test method precludes rigorous evaluation and measurement uncertainty, an estimation shall be made. A laboratory performing calibrations, including its own equipment, shall evaluate the measurement uncertainty. Evaluate is more like the picture on top, the rigorous type of calculations. An estimation would be sort of not as detailed, perhaps sort of scientifically, if you could picture a fellow up there estimating a jar full of jelly beans, for example. It's not an exact, but it's a sort of portraying what an estimation would look like as opposed to an evaluation. So 17025 does give us some help here. They give us some additional guidance for you testing folks. So totally depends, and you folks should know what bucket your testing will fall within. So there are cases well recognized, and these are within the standard, well recognized test methods specifies limits to the value of major sources of measurement uncertainty. So it may actually be addressed within the test method. An example is specified rapid kits that are specified limits to the value of major sources contributors of uncertainty, as well as well recognized rapid method where kits are used to determine qualitative results. Another note, regarding testing for a particular method where the measurement uncertainty of the results has been established and verified that there is no need to evaluate the measurement uncertainty for each parameter if the laboratory can demonstrate that the identified critical influences factor and under control. So if you're a testing organization, you know, for the purpose of this assessment, it's not, you need to make the determination, and I'm the calibration person. So when I do assessments, I'm looking for that budget. If you're testing folks, got a little bit more flexibility here. You got to determine your test method, and do you need to do a rigorous uncertainty estimation, such as a calibration lab, or does it fall within one of these buckets as specified in the notes here? Okay, so that was our tie at number 10. We're going to move on to number 7.7, ensuring the validity of the results. So again, this is an area where the lab is required to have a procedure for monitoring the validity of results. The resorting data shall be recorded in such a way that trends are detected, and where practical, statistical techniques such as applied to review the results. This monitor shall be planned and reviewed, and shall include, where appropriate but not limited to. So I purposely highlighted the word shall there. What I have down in the bottom there is the excerpt from 2005. So we're language is a little bit stronger here. A may is a permission. Remember, shall is a requirement. So if you're an organization, this list we're about to look at here under 7.7.1, you shall take a look at these, and where appropriate, should be utilizing these. These would be things like with your testing folks, a lot of things might be included right in the testing protocol, controlled samples, spikes, blanks, things like that, calibration labs, things like control charts, you know, is a thing that comes to mind, checks against perhaps working standards, things like that. So some of the things that we need to be looking at here, things like a couple I just mentioned here. Reference material or quality control material, use of alternative instrumentation. That's new. This was in 2005. We have some additional things here that I've sort of highlighted here with the word new. That was not in 2005. Functional checks of measuring and test equipment. Use of check or working standards. Like I said, control chart. Intermediate checks on your measurement equipment. That's an addition. Also captured in the section on equipment in the 2017 standard. Replicable test of calibrations using the same or different method, retesting a calibration, correlation of results for different characteristics. Some new things that's incorporated is review of reported results, intra-lab comparison. Technician A runs a test for calibration. Technician B runs the same test or calibration on the same artifact sample, compare their samples to each other. Testing of blind samples. You know, perhaps you already know what the results shall be, so have another technician perhaps test it, not knowing that it's going to be used in perhaps a QA program and test it just like they would any other sample or artifact that comes into the lab. So all these things I mentioned so far are internal controls. They are done within the confines of the four walls. So 2017 has been expanded, and you see the word shall. So that's that's a requirement. Where available and appropriate. So we realize there may be some exceptions, and we address that in our policy, which we'll get to here in a little bit. On PL1. So this is pretty much written in conjunction to what we have in place with PL1. So there's the new requirement. So the standard is looking for you to compare your results to results outside your organization. And that can be done by proficiency testing. So there are organizations and groups that are in the business of doing proficiency testing. We mentioned 17043. That's actually a ISO standard for proficiency testing providers. That's noted there. Interlab comparison, other than proficiency testing. So we refer to that simply as interlab in our PL1. That's where your organization and another organization can test the same sample, same calibrate the same artifact, and then you have to compare the results. You have to compare them in a meaningful way. Have to have some sort of predefined limits of acceptance. So again, that's a change as far as the standard is concerned. However, PL1 is already in tune with that because we already require the use of third party or interlab comparison. And if it's not available or appropriate, we do require you to put that request in writing. We'll look at that in a little bit, stating why your third party or interlab cannot be completed, and then how you plan to conduct the test, either intralab or repeatability, and analyze the data in a meaningful way. That's what I also have up here, and this is captured in the standard, and it's always been required. That monitoring activities shall be analyzed and used to control, if applicable, improve laboratory activity. If the results of the analysis of data from monitoring activity are found to be outside predefined limits criteria, appropriate actions shall be taken to prevent incorrect results from being reported. So whenever you're doing these monitoring activities, it should be a record behind them. Yep, it's fine. You're doing them, looking for a record showing that it's being done, and then looking for some criteria. Hey, is this data acceptable? Some sort of predefined limits of acceptance. Those of you that do interlab proficiency tests, I know a lot of folks, and I've come across them interlab. These are our results. These are lab A results, and this is lab B results. Okay, I need to see an analysis of the data. Are they comparable? And what criteria are you basing that on? And with interlab test or intralab, we e-normal analysis, z-test, things like that should accompany the data from both organizations if you are actually doing like an interlab or any other the monitoring activities, control charts, spike samples, things like that. All right, moving down the list, number 8, impartiality. This is the very first section in the standard. The main thing in 2017 is magnified. It has its own section right at the very beginning of standard. It has several clauses in it. So it's actually defined in the standard as a presence of objectivity. So it's now the standard places more importance on how impartiality is issued, how issues are handled. And it's more of an ongoing activity. It's not a one-time thing. Employees perhaps are made aware of it, sign a sort of agreement, and that's the end of it. So the standard place is more of an ongoing, this is a more of an ongoing activity. So requirements from the standards, laboratory activities shall be taken impartially and structured in management as to safeguard impartiality. So therefore, it's more important for labs to show how you have handled the issue of impartiality. The laboratory shall be responsible for the impartiality of its laboratory activities. And laboratory activities extend beyond the testing or calibration activity. It also incorporates activities such as internal audits, procurement, and maintenance. So when we refer to laboratory activities, it's also these other activities. It's not just the folks that are doing the nuts and bolts of performing the daily testing, calibration, or sampling. It's also the functions such as internal auditing, you know, procurement, complying with what we went over on externally provided products and services, like defining that criteria, or maintenance. These are all other functions that this would incorporate. The laboratory management shall be committed to impartiality. Can be demonstrated that this, of course, is not all encompassing. Things such as having an impartiality policy, or involve a statement about impartiality in the quality policy. discussing impartiality on the management review, and to include discussions and decisions in the meeting of the minutes. Documentation, training, and agreement of staff, including the top management, on potential threats to impartiality. The laboratory shall be responsible for impartiality of its laboratory activity and shall not allow commercial, financial, or other pressures to compromise impartiality. It puts more responsibility on the laboratory and ideally would have some sort of safeguards in place. So any undue pressures would be removed or addressed if it posed a threat to impartiality. This is the one that when I'm going through this assessment, and we have a shall associated here, and we know risk in the 2017 standard. Actually, that didn't make the top 10 list, but there's a whole new section on risk and opportunities. When I'm looking at this section here under impartiality, the laboratory shall identify risk to impartiality. So when I'm going to section 8.5, I'm looking as an assessor that any risk to impartiality has been reviewed. Not saying that there are any, just that, based on the requirement here that it's been reviewed and any risk, perhaps there is no risk. What's going to be done to keep it that way? If there are risk, what's going to be done to minimize the risk? Or if there are risk involved, perhaps what's going to be done to totally avoid that risk? So when you're doing your internal audit, when you get to 414, when you see that shall here for risk to impartiality, you may want to crosswalk over to 8.5. I can tell you as an assessor, that is something that I look for based on this requirement. I crosswalk this over to 8.5. So things, including impartiality, should make a risk analysis of it, should be incorporated in contract review. The standard does have some notes in it that specifies relationships. It's not just with your customer, as personnel, could be ownership. Various other things are noted as far as relationships that can propose a threat to impartiality. Management review, internal audits, and performance review can provide inputs to identify any risk to personnel. So as a standard requires ongoing basis, so it's important to identify changes in laboratory activities that may become a risk. Even if there are no changes in the laboratory activity, the impartiality risk analysis should be at least reviewed during the management review. So just looking for some sort of record here that it's been done. The risk to impartiality has been evaluated. All right, at number 7 here, this is our policy. And again, when we do a assessment, of course, the standard's been revised. And it's to the requirement to 17025 2017. It's also against the accreditation body's policies. So speaking on behalf of Perry Johnson Laboratory Accreditation, we are an ILAC signatory. ILAC has policy documents. Hence, us as an ILAC signatory, when we are assessed to that 17011 standard, we have to show that we are complying with ILAC policies. Hence, we have our policies in place to assure that we are, and we are having our accredited organizations comply. So this first one, PL1, is proficiency testing. So we sort of hit on that under validity of testing and calibration results. PL1, prior to accreditation. So if you're not accredited yet, you have to have proficiency tests under your belt. You have to have at least one proficiency test completed, and it has to meet the requirements stated within PL1. So you're not going to get accredited unless this has been completed. And it's not a one-time thing. So proficiency testing is required to be done annually. So every year you have to assure you're doing proficiency testing. Even if you have one line item on your scope of accreditation, that proficiency test has to be completed every year. PL under 3.2 there, you see the requirement and the reference to the proficiency testing plan. And PL1 goes into detail about disciplines, sub-disciplines, but the laboratory is also required to develop a four-year proficiency plan. I mentioned a template there, LF81, that which is available to document a four-year plan. So basically, prior to accreditation, you have to have proficiency testing completed, have to do proficiency tests every year, and they have to be done in conjunction with an approved four-year plan. And the proficiency testing has to be in an appropriate means of proficiency testing. Excuse me. So what is approved means of proficiency testing? Third party. So participation in proficiency testing sponsored by a third party accredited provider, 17043. We do accept, and we do have a listing on our website of other PT providers that we have reviewed. So participate, not necessarily accredited to 17043. We're going down the pecking order here from most desirable to least desirable here. But A, B, and C here are all acceptable means of proficiency testing. So proficiency testing program sponsored by a third-party provider, not necessarily accredited. ABC interlab comparison. So you're, again, we're outside the four walls of your organization here, like the standard stated, comparison to results by other organizations. Where available and appropriate. So these are all approved means of proficiency testing. Then we also reference intra-lab comparisons and repeatability studies. And I prefaced this when we were talking about the duty of test and calibration results earlier, that we require, if you're going to proceed with one of these types of proficiency tests, just don't do it if you're accredited with us. You need to have our approval on that. So intra-lab is where, say, technicians just within your organization does an intra-lab comparison. Repeatability study, you know, that's the least desirable. You know, that's just basically, it could be a perhaps maybe you have one person that's able to perform this unique test or calibration, and then basically just showing that results can be repeated. The problem I have with repeatability study is that, it might show that it can be repeated, but is it repeating the right thing there, the right result? So again, with any one of these, you need to have our approval prior to incorporating them into your four-year plan, or of course doing them prior to your initial accreditation. That request, and there's a note on the bottom basically stating what needs to be done. The request needs to state why third party or interlab is not feasible, and how you plan to conduct the test and analyze the data in a meaningful way. So, for example, and I do calibration, if I saw, for example, somebody request an intra lab comparison to do gauge blocks, to do a pressure gauge, something like that, there is no way that's going to be approved, because there are plenty of third-party providers out there that your organization can go to. And so in those cases, you would either have to use that third-party source or conduct an interlab test. All right. Number six, continuing with our countdown here, is the section on personnel. No substantial changes have been prominent in this area is the need to supervise before authorization and to monitor after authorization the personnel. One thing that is no longer required, however, I'm still seeing them used a lot, is the concept of job descriptions. That's something that's not required, but you'll see here in a little bit that you're still required to communicate to your folks their duties, responsibilities, their authorities, and a job description can be the vehicle that's pulled out to show compliance to that, but it's not required anymore. all personnel of the laboratory, internal and external subcontractors that could influence the laboratory activity shall act impartially, be competent, and work in accordance with the laboratory management system. So we're hitting impartiality again here in personnel. Competent. So one thing that I like to stress, this is, again, all laboratory personnel, not just the folks that are doing the testing, calibration, sampling, and I prefaced here, the internal auditor would fall under here. Internal auditor needs to be competent. It used to be stated in 2005, trained, and wherever possible, independent of the activity being audited. That can be crosswalked now over to this section in 6.2 under personnel. Still with personnel, 6.2.2, the lab shall document the competence requirement for each function influencing the results of laboratory activities, including requirements for education, qualification, training, technical skills, and experience. Again, a shall is a requirement, shall be documented. And again, that could still be done in, and I have seen this captured still in job descriptions. Lab shall ensure personnel have the competence to perform laboratory activities for which they are responsible and to evaluate the significance of deviations. There you see the requirement about communicating to the personnel duties, responsibilities, and authorities. Again, no formal requirement for a job description, but if you think about it, in 2005, would ask for it. There was a shall there. I need to see the job description. That's a requirement. It's no longer required here, but it can still be used when, perhaps when I'm as an assessor or an internal auditor, if you are looking for where those competence requirements are documented, could still be documented in a job description. Okay, 6.2.5, have procedures and retain records. So again, procedure, how it is done, and retaining records showing it has been done. Determining competence requirements, selection of personnel, training of personnel, supervision of personnel, authorizing of personnel. An addition is monitoring of competence of personnel. So I know we have a experience, I do assessments, folks have a experienced staff, been doing them, doing their areas of, in my case, calibration for some time. According to this new requirement, you still have to monitor their competence. Have to have something in place. How is it being done, and creating a record showing it is done. I like to, specify with proficiency testing, for example, if all personnel are involved in proficiency testing. That is a good way to monitor their competence. Could be incorporated into 6.2.5.F. Authorization. The laboratory shall authorize personnel to perform laboratory activities, including but not limited to the following: development, modification, verification, and validation of methods. Next one, B, analyzing of results, including statements of conformity and interpretation. And C, report, review, and authorization of results. So reporting the results, reports now, they have to be reviewed prior to being released, and the individual has to be captured who authorized the results. So even if it's the same individual that is actually doing the test or calibration, I still see that in a lot of smaller organizations. You have to show that they are actually issuing the report as well. You have to show that they've been authorized to do so. All right, number five, selection, verification, and validation of methods. So in general, this is your procedures, your testing, calibration, sampling protocol that you're following. And in a nutshell, not a whole lot of changes in this section. Still, right here at the top of our list at number five, the section's been reorganized, and it's now written more strongly to differentiate as to when lab has to verify that it can properly perform methods versus when the lab has to validate methods. So verify, just if you adopt a say a nationally recognized procedure, and you put that to use, you still have to verify that you're capable of performing that procedure. There we have back the definition. The definition of verification and validation is captured in the standard. If you have to validate your result, your method, you have to have records as always, and there's been some addition to those records that are needed, which is the determination of the performance characteristics of the methods and a statement on validity of the methods detailing its fitness for intended use. And as always, you know, the main thing is you're using appropriate methods and procedures. Again, if you're if you're been assessed with us, or you're going to be going through an initial assessment, your assessor, they're authorized by PJLA to go out and assess your lab, and our assessors are technically competent in the organization that they're going to be assessing. They've had been involved in the industry before. They have experience in the industry. We we assure that. So they would not send me out. For example, I'm a calibration person. I've never been involved in cannabis testing. I would not be going to a cannabis lab because I would not know what the appropriate procedure would be and when an appropriate procedure is being used. So the assessor that assesses you all is technically competent in the areas and would know what procedures are appropriate and which are not. Okay, running down the list, internal audits. So not a whole lot new here. Some you can see the requirements here. It still comes in at number 4. I think I might have a good idea why. We'll get to that in a little bit here. The importance, you can see this magnifies with the internal audit, shall take into account the importance of laboratory activities, concerns, changing affecting a laboratory, and the results of previous audits. You need to go back and visit previous audits. Was there any findings? Have they been corrected? Was the corrective action closed? Was it effective? No significant changes. Like I said before, that was a requirement. Who does the internal auditing? That's actually covered in a couple places here. Well, competence and impartiality is what's required in the first two sections of the standard apply. And competence also, and personnel, that also incorporates the internal auditor. So just one thing with the, if you're transitioning to the new standard, if I'm going to do your assessment and I'm looking for you to comply to the 2020 and 2017 standard, I want to see your audit done to that standard. So you have to show that you're going to be auditing to the 2017 standard. You see the requirements there. Which specifies the internal auditor audit conforms to the lab's own requirements of its management system, including the laboratory activities and the requirements of this document. So if you're doing in your internal audit that you're transitioning, you want to look at the 2017 standard and not the 2005 standard and incorporate those changes into your internal audit program. And provide the objective evidence that you are going to be performing internal audits, or ideally have done an internal audit. And ideally, you want to do the internal audit prior to your assessment to assure that you are complying with the standard. So right behind the internal audit is the management review. Sort of as far as when they're done, that's typically what's recommended is that your management review is done shortly after your internal audit, because the internal audit is one of the inputs of the management review. Again, if you've done your management review, if you're transitioning to the 2017 standard, you want to make sure that you're meeting these requirements. So we're not looking at the 2005 requirements. We're looking at 2017, and there are. This is an area that's been expanded. So it's been rewritten. There was a note recommending every 12 months. That's been erased. You still have to define the predefined schedule, and you need to put the assure that you're meeting your predefined schedule. So I can tell you with a management review, that's probably the first thing as an assessor. I'll look at that predefined schedule that you establish, assure that the management review is meeting that. Then I'll make sure all these required inputs and outputs are included. And then I want to see a little bit of beef behind what's been recorded there. So some of the inputs have been changed. One thing I mentioned here is always customer feedback. Now includes customer and personnel feedback. Instead of recommendations for improvement, it's been modified to effectiveness of any implemented improvements. So here we see the inputs. A lot of these are repetitive from the 2005 standard, but we have some additions here. As you see, M, risk of results of risk identification. So these are all additions that were not captured in 2005. And what I really like about the management review, and I'm a strong believer, you know, with internal auditing, yeah, that's a vehicle for compliance. You're looking for compliance to your own system, your compliance to the standard, compliance to PJLA's policies. Management reviews, you know, ideally, this is a vehicle for improvement. Ideally, we'll have some good output here. So the management review, and if you notice here, we have the required input section, and they need to be recorded. But also in the output section, you have to record decisions and actions related to these elements, A, B, C, D, the effectiveness of the management system and its processes, improvement of the laboratory activity related to the fulfillment of the requirements of this document, being the 17025, provisions of required resources and need for change. So we just, when we're looking at the record for the management review, you just don't stop at the required inputs. And you see, you need to also record these outputs. And hopefully, like I said, a management review will ideally present some opportunities for improvement and actually be a beneficial tool for your organization. Okay, getting down to the bottom here of our list. Section 6.4 is equipment. Again, kind of surprising, this is an area where there's not a whole lot of changes. One of the biggest ones is it sort of magnifies when you need to verify as opposed to calibrate your equipment. And that, as far as calibration, you know, it's pretty much business as usual. You have to have calibrate and traceability in place. If the accuracy or uncertainty affects the validity of results, and of course traceability. So if you're needed to provide traceability, then your equipment has to be calibrated, i.e. by a traceable source. There's more reference to 17034, which is a standard and actually is one of the standards that we also have under our umbrella at Perry Johnson, proficiency testing providers, 17034. So if you're using reference material to assure, you know, traceability, you would go to the a competence of the organization. 17034 is the standard. So the laboratory shall verify that equipment conforms to specified requirements before being placed or returned into services. So this clause specifies a requirement to verify equipment conforms to specified requirements before being placed into or returned to service, which is different from what was stated in 2005, and that equipment needed to be calibrated or checked. A little bit of difference in the language there, but as far as the difference between verify and just checked, referred to in 2005 standard. So again, it's very specific as to when equipment has to be calibrated, when it affects the uncertainty, or when traceability is needed. And the equipment should be capable of achieving the measurement accuracy and or measurement uncertainty required to perform a valid result. So if you have if you have to capture temperature within an accuracy of half a degree, that device over to the left-hand side may not be the proper equipment to fulfill that need. Again, what I have stated here is if you're going to a provider, say a calibration provider, you want to look at their ranges and CMC. Their CMC is the best uncertainty they can actually produce. Saying that your device is going to meet that CMC, but if your device perhaps is going to meet a tighter need than that CMC, then you perhaps need to look for another source. Have to establish calibration programs. What's new is it has to be reviewed and adjusted if necessary. So that's always a big question. How often do we have to have our equipment calibrated? Basically, you have to set that program. It has to be reviewed. So ideally, you get a little bit history behind your instruments, can determine, hey, perhaps we need to do it more often, or perhaps we can take a little risk here. Equipment's very stable, and we can perhaps adjust it a little bit longer. Calibration status needs to be readily available. So the concept of a label is gone. However, I've still seen a lot of calibration labels on equipment. If I did not, as an assessor, if I did not see a calibration, say you're using a pipette for an example, and I look at the pipette and I want to see, is this in calibration? When was it due? If the label's not on there under the 2017 standard, that does not necessarily mean a non-conformance. The calibration status needs to be readily available. So if I ask the technician, when is this instrument due for calibration, if the technician can pull it up on, say, their laptop and tell me within 10 seconds, I would consider that readily identifiable. If I don't hear the answer to that question until the close of business, perhaps that day, that may not be considered readily available. But if your cap cannot be more readily available if a label is still used. However, that's no longer required. Safeguards, so always been required that the equipment be safeguarded from adjustments. Just worded a little bit differently in 2017. Records, so always looking for equipment records where applicable. So you maintain a master list of equipment or still in the file cabinets, wherever they happen to be, just have to, where applicable, assure that records are maintained and that these items A, B, C, I'm not going to read them. I'll just leave them up there for y'all folks to review. Some things where applicable, you need to have records for your equipment. Current location, where applicable. If you're a calibration lab and you have 10 technicians and they're assigned different equipment, then that would be applicable. Or if you have different locations, everything is located right there in a fixed facility, that would be an example where it's not going really applicable. Everything is right there in one location under 64D there. Okay, at the very top of the list, we're at number one here. Reporting the results. The best advice, you know, I like to give labs and is when you're doing your internal auditing, you could write all these wonderful things in a QA manual that your reports will include. Basically, recite the requirements from 17025. If you're preparing for an audit or you're doing a reaccreditation, you're gonna want to look at some real live animals. In other words, real reports that you produced, and assure that they're meeting the requirements of Section 7-8, reporting the results. One thing I liked about the 2005 standard, I like to sort of correlate here, was this was the end product. In the standard in 2005, we looked at the personnel, we looked at the traceability, we looked at the equipment, the environment, all those things. The end result is what you're providing your customers, good, accurate test or calibration results that comply with 17025. That was at the end of the standard. But if you think about it, that's what we're looking at here. The final product. So there are some key differences here. So between the two standards, and you can see this is at the top of the list. This is an area where PJLA have been writing the most findings. So when we do, when we're doing assessments, that's what we're looking at. We're looking at reports that's been produced, and we're cross-referencing it against these requirements in 17025, Section 7-8. So a new requirement is that the results shall be reviewed and authorized prior to release. The concept of simplified reporting, that's still in place. As far as a written requirement, that's been erased from the 2005. I would say, however, if you're still doing any sort of simplified reporting, that you capture that agreement. That's a recommendation from me. However, with simplified reporting, if you are not recording all the required elements as agreed to by your customer, you still need to be able to create a record as to, oh, let's say, for example, they don't want the raw data, for example. They just want the intolerance, out of tolerance recorded. You still have to create a record or have a record shown where need be, you can go back and duplicate a report fully compliant with 7-8. You still have the record showing what that raw data is. So common requirements, this area divides up between testing, calibration, and sampling. The first area is common to all three. What's included? And I can tell you, when I do an assessment, I would ask an organization, have you done anything with your reports as far as updating and providing me a report that complies with 2017? They tell me, no, I can write the non-conformance even before I look at a report normally. And they center around the differences. Date of issue is new. So two dates here, date of test and date of issue. Even if there's the same date, report has to be reviewed and authorized prior to being released. That is the date that needs to be captured. If you authorize a technician to do the test and they're also authorized to review and release reports, and it happens to be the same date, that date needs to be reported twice, date of test or calibration and also date of issue. Identification of the person authorizing the report. So it's got to be clearly identified who authorized that report. A clear indication when results are from external providers. So if you're subcontracting, you have to clearly indicate them on your report that those results are from subcontractors. The lab is responsible for information, and this is a new information on the report, except when information is provided by the customer. Data provided by the customer shall be clearly identified. Disclaimers put on the report. When report information is supplied by the customer, customer, and can affect the validity of results. And when the sample is provided by the customer, it shall state in the report the results applied to the sample as received. So a couple things here. First of all, let me just, on that sample, very last item there. If your customer brings you in a sample and ask your organization to test it, you have to specify, you had no control over how that sample was obtained. It could be a replica sample of a larger lot, who knows? Just got to specify on the report the sample as received. So the sample, if your customer actually provided you the sample, that needs to be specified. This other area, and one thing I like to zoom in on, and this is strongly identified in the standard under the handle of calibration items. For those folks that are doing on-site calibrations, if you have set environmental parameters where your test or calibration are to be performed. If you go into a customer location and they're outside of those parameters, you are actually deviating from it. So what this is saying in that example, you need to gain customer's approval and you need to put a disclaimer if the customer wants you to proceed with the calibration anyhow, that deviation is put on the report. It could possibly affect the validity of the results. For calibration labs, now we're at 7.8 specifically, measurement uncertainty. That is a requirement. It is a shall there. It no longer states measurement uncertainty and or a statement of compliance. We removed the gray area there, you know, as far as I'm concerned from 2005, because, you know, as far as I was always concerned, you know, measurement uncertainty needed to be included on the report. And that's for whatever reason, the organization specified that it is not to be included. By definition, your measurements are not traceable without the measurement uncertainty. Standard is very clear now. Shall include uncertainty that and or a statement of compliance is no longer there. Sampling. So if you're in a sampling organization, got some some additional requirements. Where the lab is responsible for the sampling activity, in addition to the requirements that we just went through, the report shall include the following, where necessary for the interpretation of the results. Have to include any information, if the sampling is a component of uncertainty, the sampling organization has to include a statement of uncertainty on their report. So I'm a testing organization. I need, if that's part of my estimation of uncertainty, I need to know what the uncertainty is for obtaining that sample. So if you're a sampling organization, you may need to report the uncertainty on there. All right, statements of conformity. Those of you, I just did a webinar not that long ago on here. I've done a couple of them on this area. Statement of conformity. So this is when you're saying something passes or fails. Intolerance, out of tolerance. That's what we're referring to. So if you're just reporting the results, here they are, and you're not saying pass, fail, intolerance, out of tolerance, you're not making a statement of conformity. If you're a calibration lab and you're providing results and you're not saying pass, fail, intolerance, out of tolerance, this area is not applicable. If you are, though, then this area is applicable. And a decision rule is, and it's actually what I had it defined here, it's how you take measurement uncertainty into account. So when you make a statement of compliance, you have to take measurement uncertainty into account. And what you have to document is the decision rule employed, taking into account the level of risk, such as false accept and false reject, statistical assumptions associated with the decision rule, employed and apply the decision rule. So in a case where, say, an instrument is very close to failing, but the actual result is in the pass area, if you're taking measurement uncertainty into account, you may not be able to say that the instrument passes because it could actually fail. It could also be the other way around. With the decision rule, and it didn't make the top 10 list under contract review, your customer has to agree to your decision rule. So that was not captured on this presentation. Go back to I recorded one on review requests, tenders, and contracts, where we go into a little bit more depth in capturing the customer agreement on the decision rule. So whatever decision rule is captured on the report, that had to be agreed to by your customer. And could be very strict guard banding. It could be something as simple as simple acceptance, which seems to be a popular decision rule because basically, with that, you're not taking measurement uncertainty into account. Just bear in mind, your customer has to agree to that up in front. And the level of false accept needs to be documented. It needs to be taken into account. And in those cases, that could be up to 50%. So again, yeah, 7862, if you're making a statement of conformance, it clearly has to identify the decision rule, unless it's inherited and the required specifications or standard. All right. So we're getting into reporting opinions and interpretation. So if they're being placed on report, only authorized personnel can do that. If communicated by dialogue with the customer, a record of the dialogue shall be retained. That's a requirement now. That was a note in 2005. One addition under amendments is if you make a change to a report, if you reissue a report, you always had to give it a unique identifier. You had to specify the report that it replaces. What's additional here is any change of information shall be clearly identified and where appropriate, the reason for the change, included in the report. So the concept of where appropriate, the reason for the change included in the report is an addition. All right, so that was our top 10 list. I certainly hope you were having issues or not sure about any of those new requirements in that area, that you were able to get some guidance from this presentation. But bear with me a minute here. I do got some questions here, and I got quite a few questions here, which is good. Apparently, I had some audio problem at first. I'm not sure when that was. I certainly hope that wasn't throughout the presentation. I did start the start recording right at right at 1 o'clock Eastern. I'm on the East Coast Eastern time. Apparently, will a hard copy of presentation be available? Yes, I did go over that at the beginning on our website. We do have a webinar tab. You can get the slides, or you can go back and listen to the actual recording. There's a wealth of information there. So if there was an area here that was not covered, I can assure you, I've done a webinar on it. If it relates to 17025 and the 2017 standard, those recordings are available on our website, and also the slides. We started putting those up there. It's been several months now. And, you know, again, you know, some of the what would be a sufficient safeguard for financial impartiality? I'm really not sure, you know, if you have, I guess, if you have interest in the organization, what we're talking about here is your testing and calibration, that if you have a financial interest, that person removes themselves from being involved directly in the testing or calibration, I guess, would be a good safeguard. You know, that's the first thing that comes to mind, is to remove, you know, that particular individual from the testing and calibration or sampling activity. Oop. This did go on long. I have a couple that had to sort of leave earlier. Could you please clarify when the phrase "shall have a procedure" is used? Does that always mean existence of a procedure has to be documented, or does existence of records suffice as evidence of a procedure? A procedure, when it says you shall have a procedure, or shall have a procedure and a record. Like I said, a procedure tells you how to do something, and then a record shows you that it's been done. So if it says you have to have a procedure, you know, you have to have something documented showing how it's being accomplished. Training of personnel, you shall have a procedure. You shall also have records showing that it's being done. So it could be a formal procedure, it could be a flow chart, it could be electronically driven through a LIM system, but something in place showing and instruction how something is done when it says you shall have a procedure. Yes, you will have access to the slides. Shall we calibrate it? Okay, well, this next question, I'm not sure if it was actually part of today's. Oh, well, I guess we did. Equipment was on the top 10 list. Should we calibrate a balance if moved from one location in the lab to another location, one bench to another bench, or only check is sufficient? If you have a good system of intermediate checks on your balances, I would say a check would be sufficient for just the move. Just bear in mind, and I do watch even a lot of technicians calibrate balances and scales. And when I see a technician walk up to a balance, and the first thing they do is start adjusting the level on the balance, I stop them. And I tell them, you know, your as found data is the same as the as used data. That's how they were using it. So if you go in, you make all those adjustments, and then you do your as found data, and they came out fine, and you didn't alert your customer to that, and they weren't aware of that, it wasn't really being calibrated as used. If you left it out of level, for example, start testing it, and got the true as used data, and you saw a fluctuation when you leveled it, then you could sort of educate your customer a little bit there. But I would say if you move it, if you have a good system of intermediate checks, if you're checking your balances with test weights anyway, and you have some data to support it, then the verification should be fine. You know, as long as you have a predefined limits of acceptance, and when you move the device, it still operates within those predefined limits. So, you know, it depends on where you're moving it to. There could be something affecting it. It could be a vibration issue, a current issue, things like that, depending on how sensitive the balance is. So you want to make sure that the balance is verified. If you are verifying it, it should be okay just to run the verification if you have a good system of intermediate checks on it anyhow. We list the date of test completion on our reports, which is also usually the date of issue. But sometimes a report is issued after the date of completion. Is that acceptable? Yeah, you have to have two dates on the report. If the report date, if the test is one day and it's actually issued on the same date, that date is going to be reported as twice, date of test and date of issue. If the issue date is the next day, 2 days, the following week, that is the date that's going to be captured under the date of issue. So either way, if it's the same date on the test date and the issue date, the report needs to specify that date as being both as the test date, calibration date, and also the issue date. Is the range of the laboratory activities the same as scope of accreditation, or is something else? Well, if you're just referring to the testing and calibration and 17025 activities, then that would be the scope of accreditation, those particular items. So it's specified in the standard range of activity of laboratory activities as it relates to this document. So that would be your 17025, your testing and calibration activities, but everything that also feeds into them, like the internal auditing, the procurement, all those other things. So all those things would feed into what's on the current scope of accreditation. With the disclaimer on the report, when the sample is provided by the customer, is it still permissible to not have that on the report when it is agreed in writing by the customer? Okay, well, for whatever reason, I don't know why a customer would want that, but if I was a lab, that's something that you might want to protect yourself against. I'm not sure what area you're involved in here. Like I said, if a customer brings me in a sample, I have no idea how that sample was obtained. If for whatever reason the customer want and you feel it's appropriate to do so, and bear in mind it says under simplified reporting, if agreed to by the customer, you still have to go back and be able to duplicate those results. So somewhere you need to have a record of that the customer did bring in that sample. I don't know, that's kind of a hard one. I'm a calibration person, but I would stay away from that. I would say it's not an appropriate, if I was a technical person in the lab, I think if a customer is bringing in a sample, that could actually impact the validity of my testing results. If I have, I didn't have control over that sample, or it didn't come from a recognized sample in organization, or if the lab itself didn't take out the sample. I would say, it's kind of a gray area there. I would say technically, yes, if they agree to it, but I would sort of try to stay away from that. And if I was probably a technical person, I probably wouldn't agree to that with a customer. All right, let's see here. I guess an extenuation of the question I just answered. Is organization like A2LA have to be evaluated? Yes, we're A2LA, Perry Johnson, anybody who is under the ILAC arrangement, we are evaluated by them. So we're, fortunate to have been involved in that process for PJLA. And anyone who is an ILAC signatory is subjected to their evaluation. The standard is 17011. We have to do a lot of the same things that's in 17025. We have internal audits, management reviews, corrective actions, those sorts of things. They also go out and, like we witness you folks do testing and calibration, they witness us do assessments. So yes, A2LA, they're a signatory. When you put a logo on there, if you have that ILAC logo in conjunction with the PJLA logo, you've got that permission to do so. That ILAC logo shows that we are a recognized MRA. A2LA falls under that same premise, and we've been evaluated just like they have been, and vice versa. So, yes. I don't see the relation. I have a question here again. I'm not real sure what the question is. How to comply with legal enforcement commitment to impartiality and confidentiality. Not real sure what the question is there. If there are statutory requirements, legal requirements that pertains to your organization, you have to comply with them. There should be no impartiality or confidentiality involved. So if you could expand on that a little bit more, I'm not really sure what the question is. This next one, this is my opinion on, I said opinion on this, but it is a good question because it does come up a lot. I have seen this come up a lot. And I know, you know, if you have a, one thing I do like when I go into an organization, if I see the same faces there every year, it makes my job a lot easier. You have stability in your company. That speaks volumes, I think. For a testing lab that is looking for accreditation and has been in business for decades with many long-term employees, what is the best way to document test procedure training and competence to meet the requirements? And my take on that is, you ever hear the grandfathered in? You have to create a training record. I would start one for all your folks and just basically some sort of statement based on 10 years of experience and, you know, whatever protocol you have in place as far as following up on their performance and perhaps even monitoring their performance have been done over the last 15 and have been performing satisfactory over those 15 years. I would sort of consider them as grandfathered. I would create a record like that. However, you still got to monitor their performance. So that's a new requirement. Like I said, if I have a junior technician, you have somebody that's been with you 20 years, new requirement is you have to have a procedure and retain records for monitoring. So whatever you determine you're going to put in place for monitoring, you would build on upon that. I would say that if I was in your shoes, that's the way I would handle it. If I, you know, had a complete confidence in my folks and I can crucially adhere to their performance over the 10 years and that's been demonstrated and just sort of grandfather them in, but create a record that what you're basing that on. Does the final report need to state reviewed and approved, or is reviewed? Well, bear with me. I'm having a little trouble reading. Actually, I just want to go to the standard, make sure I'm giving the correct answer here. Okay, the requirement is the identification of the person authorized in the report. I believe that's what you're referring to. This is under 7821. Oh, it was an octopus. So it's the authorized in the report. And your question is reviewed and authorized, or is reviewed by sufficient? I would say, to cover your bases and looking at what the requirement is there to alleviate any gray area, you have to identify the person who authorized the report. So I would either say authorized by or reviewed and authorized. It would be my take on that. And I'm just basing that on, if you want to go back and look at the requirement, there's a shall there under 7821, O is an octopus. So if reading that requirement, and based on what that says, that's the basis of me saying you need to stay authorized by or reviewed and authorized by. Yeah, In relation to the paragraph, I guess in equipment 6413D, I guess that's the location of the equipment instrument is not indented. Is it a non-conformance? It says where appropriate. If I was an assessor and I felt that was, it's not appropriate to, is there a reason to list the location? I would not write that up as a non-conformance. I don't know what the specific case is. You know, if it's a piece of equipment that stays right there in the lab, you don't have different locations, you don't have different technicians that are assigned equipment, I would not consider that a non-conformance. Can you please share? I'm trying to get to the bottom here. I'm getting a lot of questions that keep coming in. Please share your website detail to download today's webinar. Just go to our website. We have a tab, right? pjlabs.com. And excuse me, before I even continue, I'm just really getting ahead of myself. And I hope I didn't lose anybody. I apologize for that. And if you have a colleague that left, that's our next webinar, actually. I meant to present that before I got into the questions. About a month from now, the 29th of October, we're going to look at Section 8.9, Management Reviews. That's a Thursday, same time, same channel. And actually, we have the complete listing to the end of the year of our webinars. I know the last one is we have one on the uncertainty. We get a lot of questions and requests for more on uncertainties. That's going to be covered here. I'm not sure exactly if that's December or November, but next month is management reviews. And that was actually on our top 10 list. I believe it came in at perhaps number 3. But what made me think of that, can you please share on the website details to download today's webinar? Go to our website right there under the webinar tab. And it's not going to be available right now when I'm done here. And folks at our main office in Michigan will assure that this webinar will be provided to you. Can a calibration technician authorize and review the certificate? Yes, but you have to show that they are authorized to do so. So if you want to capture that they're authorized to perform a specific test or calibration, but you also have to also capture their authorization to review and release reports. But yes, I have come across that just recently where a matrix captured both the record of authorization and the record to perform a specific test. What if the report date, often the same as the review date and issue date, differ? I'm not sure what the question is. If they're the same date, then the same date needs to be specified twice, date of test, date of issue. If they're different dates, then it just needs to be specified in which day. Of course, the date of issue is going to be after the date of test. Both dates, excuse me, need to be specified on the report and needs to specify which one is which. How do you define technical manager? And so we didn't go over today. So actually it's no longer required as per 17025 to define a technical or quality manager. So do they authorize release of the report? That's that really a question for me. You have to authorize them. So you have to show a record of authorized report. If they're the ones that are issuing, authorizing the release of the report, then you need to capture that authorization, be it the technical manager or a senior technician or whoever it has. And it has to be the same thing about quality manager. So again, it's up to you. I mean, the standard, the 170, we didn't capture that on today's presentation, but there is no longer a requirement in the specifying the quality manual, the functions of a quality and technical manager. That's gone away. You have to identify who has overall responsibility for the lab. A lot of folks are still using quality and technical manager. And if they're authorized, you have to, it's up to you to author, to determine folks who are competent, and then you would need to show who is authorized to issue the review and authorized reports. If it happens to be the quality and technical manager, so be it, but you're the one who actually has to show the record of authorization. There is no specific requirement as to who that is. All right, sorry, I hope I got to everyone's questions there. Somebody told me, okay, well, I didn't know that. I guess I'll have to go back and look at that. didn't realize that November was on Thanksgiving Day. So I will have to look that up. So I will make sure that I make an adjustment on that. And that will be my last slide in the October webinar. Would be appreciate you bringing that to my attention, and certainly make that change. Thank you very much. And that's going to be a conclusion to today's webinar. I had a lot of good questions there. I certainly hope I got to everyone. I didn't want to some of the questions I just was not real clear on. So hopefully I hit the head on the nails of hit the nail on the head for what you were asking. So I appreciate, we had good attendance today. Thank you all for joining me, and I certainly look forward to seeing everyone at the end of October, and we'll look at the management review requirements.